Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is about your sense of smell and your unique smell. You probably know that certain parts of your body, like maybe your DNA, are just yours. You have your own fingerprints, you have your own eye prints, things like that. But you probably didn't know that no one else in the world has exactly your smell. All mammals have their own body odors that are determined by their environment and by their genes. And these are called odor types, which means that every person has a different one, unless maybe you have an identical twin who eats about the same stuff that you do. It turns out that your diet will mask that odor, but you can't completely change it. Your odor is with you. In fact, this is so useful that in Eastern Germany, post-World War II, when they would bring dissidents in, they would have to sit as they're being interrogated on a special pad in the chair. This is absolutely true. I've seen photos of the setup they used to do this. And after they sweated you for 8 or 10 hours with bright lights in your eyes, they would take the pad and they would save it in a special file. So if they needed to find you again, they could use that in conjunction with a police dog, and that could help to track you down.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us, and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's interview is with Ari Miesel. Ari is an entrepreneur, a writer, a self-tracker, triathlete, survivor of a life-threatening disease, a father, and an expert on doing less and living more, which is, of course, why we have him on the show. He comes on today to talk about how he cured his Crohn's disease and some of his best tips on productivity and efficiency. If you'd like to see the pinnacle of biohacking and productivity, you're going to want to listen to our interview today with Ari and see what he's up to. Ari Miesel is an entrepreneur, activist, speaker, and founder of Less Doing, a site dedicated to optimizing, automating, and outsourcing tasks so you can do more of what you love and less of what you don't. It's already pretty obvious now why we have him on the show today, but he's also the founder of Achievement Architecture, which helps individuals be more effective at everything. He comes on our show today to talk about how you can use achievement architecture to get more out of your life and to share his story of self-tracking and biohacking his way to curing what some people consider to be an incurable disease. So Ari's a pretty incredible guy. We're really happy to have him on the show. Ari, welcome.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me on, Dave.
You're most welcome. Well, let's jump right in. How did you get interested in what you call achievement architecture? What is it? How'd you get into it?
I've worn a lot of hats throughout my life. I started my first company when I was 12, and it was website design. And I had a couple other companies before I got out of high school. And then after I went to college, I got into construction in a very hands-on way in a development in upstate New York. And then I started doing green building. And then basically had this event happen in my life where I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. So I sort of had lots of different involvements, and they've come together in this kind of momentous and really exciting way for me. But basically, the architecture aspect and I like building things, and also the self-tracking and everything that came in with the disease, of course. So it's just kind of this confluence of everything that I've dealt with and experienced in life that's come together to this achievement architecture where I kind of help people design a more effective set of goals.
That is a really, really intriguing way of starting out our conversation. I've certainly, in my own experience of having my brain turn off and having this sort of Asperger's type of symptoms and really being 300 pounds, had that same kind of wake-up call where you just don't feel so good, and all of a sudden you realize I really have to put my full mental attention on this. When we talk with other people on the show and just people that I coach or mentor, the people who've dealt with something serious in their life almost always pay more attention to the little things because that's where the time goes away. How did you start applying your problem-solving skills there, these ones you've picked up as an entrepreneur, to curing your Crohn's disease? So when did you realize, wow, I'm sick? What did you do?
Yeah. So first, I'll just pick up on what you said there. It's paying attention to the small things. It's something that I really focus on with my clients when I'm talking about the achievement architecture, because the 80-20 rule that everybody knows about it, I think that there's a paradigm shift that needs to happen there where, yes, of course, you have to focus on the 20% to give you the 80% of the benefit. But I actually try to get people to realize that I think personally, they should be having 80% of rest, recuperation, enjoyment, entertainment, whatever, for the 20% of the time that they're actually working, rather than the other way around where we get a little bit of recuperation and then working our butts off. So anyway, the way that I, my moment was actually, it wasn't that I was just wasn't feeling well. I almost died actually. What happened was about 5 or 6 years ago, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And for those that don't know, Crohn's disease is a chronic inflammation of the digestive tract that causes strictures and narrowing of your intestines and just enormous, enormous amounts of pain on a daily basis. It's also considered to be incurable. So I was 40 pounds heavier than I am now. I was not eating very well. Having been on a construction site for 4 years, I'd been smoking a lot, which is not something in my personality in general. I was just not in a good place. And then I got diagnosed with this disease, and I started taking, after a couple of months, I was taking 16 pills a day, including systemic steroids in the form of prednisone, which were making me irritable and crazy and, my watermelon head and acne. And, I was getting up 3 times a night to go to the bathroom, which doesn't make you less irritable. I was taking a drug called 6-MP, which is a leukemia drug developed about 30 years ago. So I was essentially on chemotherapy, and my hair started thinning. I was throwing up every day for 6 months, and that also was not making me feel any better. And then all sorts of other drugs. So besides the physical pain and the constantly going to the bathroom, and it's just like emotionally this crazy beatdown. It's an awful, awful disease. And you actually become afraid of your own body and afraid of food and afraid of what might happen after each meal and each activity. And, is that slight rumble I feel, is that going to be, gas that passes, or is that going to be my next trip to the hospital? So one particularly bad night in the hospital where I literally thought I was not going to come out of it, I guess I had this moment of clarity, and I realized like something has to be done. Like medicine's not doing it for me, and something has to be done. So very fortunately for me, my wife, well, at the time my girlfriend, but now my wife, was a yoga instructor and a holistic nutrition counselor. And together we kind of decided that I needed to reboot everything. So that's basically when the journey started. I don't want to go on with the rest of the story unless you're going to ask me that question now.
That's a pretty dramatic situation there where you just realize you have to do it. So then you figured out you have something that is relatively incurable, but how did these problem solving skills, so you had some resources, you know, you're obviously a smart guy. You had a holistic nutritionist in the house with you. What did you do to start the self-tracking?
My first three companies were all in tech. So like I've always kind of a techy, geeky kind of background anyway. So I was going for pretty extensive blood tests every 5 weeks, you know, so, you know, beyond the normal testing, instead of, you know, one or two vials, it was always like six or seven every time. It was, you know, CBC and bilirubin and C-reactive protein and, you know, ferritin, like pretty much like a full workup every single time. So I would get these printouts from the doctor, and, you know, it didn't mean anything to me at the time, but I don't know what kind of possessed me to do this, but I just started putting everything in Excel spreadsheet, and I didn't really have any goal with it. And I also didn't really understand what those numbers meant at the time, but it in a way it gave me this weird sense of having a little bit of control over the situation. So I started just capturing those numbers. And then as I started to see the benefits of what I was doing with my wife, so I went completely vegan actually for a month, and that, which I don't recommend, and I know that you don't particularly recommend veganism, but I basically wanted to just reboot. So then I was vegetarian for 4 or 5 months, and then I reintroduced fish. So my diet now is pretty much pescatarian, although I can eat meat without any issues, and I've tested that. But I was collecting that data, and I was starting to feel a little better. So then I was seeing different than it had been before. And it was just like a Rain Man moment where I was like, you know, out of the 30 numbers that I've been getting every 5 weeks for the last 2 years, like this one seems off, and I'm starting to feel a little bit better. So maybe there's some sort of correlation. So it was at that point where I was like, you know what, I got to actually put these statistics together. So I started actually manipulating the data and graphing it over time. And as soon as I did that, and I had like real baseline hardcore blood numbers, which, you know, is the best I could have at the time, because obviously there's all sorts of things that can affect different factors or different biomarkers, but it gave me something real. And then I started plugging in everything else that I could think of. So started with diet. And then I played around with the mood for a little, or not mood, but like how I was feeling for a while. But I found that that was too subjective. The unfortunate thing with gut pain, because of the way that your intestines, you know, kind of wrap around and up and down and all over the place, like it's very difficult to accurately identify the qualitative aspects and the quantitative aspects of pain in your stomach or in your gut. So I found that that was not particularly useful. Plus it didn't help me to be like, I felt really bad for a week, and that doesn't, you know, that correlates to this, but it, you know, it could have been anything. Although I did determine that stress was an enormous factor in the illness and in my reaction to it, which incidentally is kind of where the less doing stuff comes from, but we'll get back to that. So I kind of got on this like obsessive kick. I started reading about quantified self. Eventually, you know, I had read Tim Ferriss's book before, but The 4-Hour Body came out. And then, you know, I started following your website, and I just started finding all these cool tests that I could do. And I was fortunate enough that I could afford to do these things. So I was like, why not? So I did genetics with 23andMe. I did a dual x-ray absorptiometry scan up at Roosevelt Hospital here, just because bone density deterioration is one of the aspects of Crohn's. You know, extra colonoscopies, which are no fun, extra blood testing, and even semen analysis, which turned out to be a really interesting metric.
That's actually really interesting. I've never thought of, I mean, I certainly the bulletproof diet and all is designed for fertility, but I've never thought of tracking semen quality as an overall indicator of health, but that's actually kind of brilliant. So how cool.
Well, the funny thing about the semen analysis, besides the fact that it was one of the creepiest experiences I've ever had in my entire life, you know, I was used to seeing all this data that was like, you know, bone density and, you know, like, grams per you know cubic inch, basically, or and then like bilirubin, you know, and like units or milligrams or units per milliliter, and you know C-reactive protein is a number between, you know, 0.1 and 0.7, and then you get the semen analysis back and it's like viscosity, opacity, motility, like it was a very different set of indicators. And my understanding also is that, especially with the medicines that I was taking, that semen quality was would react very quickly to those harsh medicines. So it was a good indicator at that point.
Now I'm going to ask you a question, and I try to not be, you know, that guy who talks about mycotoxins in every show, even though like I've done a ton of research on them. Have you looked into the relationship between aflatoxins specifically in Crohn's disease?
No, I never knew about mycotoxins before I started following your website.
Well, just do a quick Google search for Crohn's aflatoxins, and you will be shocked at the findings that most people who have Crohn's seem to have aflatoxin in their system, usually from their diet. That's why, like, I took all the aflatoxin-containing diseases out, or sorry, containing diseases, aflatoxin-containing foods, or at least most likely culprits, and pulled them out of the Bulletproof diet, because a lot of people who even sometimes think they have Crohn's, or they have ulcerative colitis, or, you know, they just have a lot of digestive problems. It's caused by, you know, basically antibiotic levels of these leftover mold contaminants in their food. So that's just another thing to explore. And fortunately, you can get blood tests to see what your levels are. So it's relatively straightforward to biohack that one.
Yeah, no, I believe me, if there's a test that I haven't done, I'm going to do it. So thank you.
So, You use the word cure. You know, you've cured an incurable disease. How did you actually cure it? Like, what makes you say it's cured, not in remission? Like your usage of words there and the way you're thinking about something that's really difficult to achieve for most people. Like, how do you know it's cured?
Part of that is a mental attitude, honestly. Remission means that it could come back anytime, as far as I'm concerned. I believe that I have beaten the hell out of this disease and it will never, ever come back. There's no signs of it in my body. My C-reactive protein levels, which is a general indicator of inflammation, but particularly related to Crohn's, is the lowest it's ever been. And I did Ironman France after I started feeling better and I wanted to really push my body. And that raised up my C-reactive protein levels, actually, not to Crohn's levels, but raised it up. So I am, at this point, it's lower than it's ever been, which I credit in a large part to krill oil, by the way. But there's such a mental aspect to it that I feel that, like, I place an enormous amount of importance on stress. I have coaching clients, or I have achievement architecture clients right now who come to me for medical reasons and they want to do biohacking stuff. And I have a client with psoriasis, which has a huge stress component to it. A lot of autoimmune, a lot of a lot of inflammatory diseases have a huge stress component to it. So as kooky as it may sound, I believe that since I believe I'm cured, then I don't get scared when, you know, I feel a little grumble in my stomach, or I don't get scared if, you know, I happen to have diarrhea because I had Mexican food, whereas before that could have been a really bad sign of something.
You said some pretty key words there. You said, you know, it's in remission, or it's as cured as it's going to be. But the bottom line is that for all of us, like, we're all basically in remission from dying, like, pretty much, unless some of the singularity guys are right in our lifetime, which is a stretch, I would say. You're looking at dying anyway, so spending all your time freaking out about it is actually, it's one of those things that leads people to make poor decisions in business and in life. Whereas it sounds like you got a little bit of an up close look at it and realized that you were going to look at your own biological response to stress, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the interesting thing overall for me, and actually this is when people ask me why I did Ironman, which was great, but it was crazy. The disease had me being a very negative person for a very long time. I was angry with my body. I was angry that why me? And I was just angry. And the disease gave me perspective on life, and I stopped sweating the small stuff in a big way. I'm a much more mellow person than I've ever been, and I just kind of don't worry about things the way that I used to. And then the reason that I believe that I went for Tough Mudder and then triathlon and then eventually Ironman was because I needed something that was even harder on my body, I felt, to give me perspective on my disease.
Speaking of stress reduction, you also mentioned in your TED Talk about how yoga improved your symptoms. Could you talk a little bit about how yoga improved your symptoms from Crohn's disease?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a kind of funny relationship with yoga because I became a yoga instructor, as I said, and I was like pretty obsessive with yoga. And after Ironman, I started doing CrossFit, and I quickly became very obsessed with CrossFit, and yoga kind of fell by the wayside, and I regret that. So I've sort of been bringing it back a little bit. Basically, a couple ways. One, the yoga itself, or the physical actions of yoga, I feel do things to your body that a lot of other exercises don't do, such as the really kind of statically held extreme twists, which I think massage the internal organs, the handstand, the practice of aversion. There's no question that kind of invigorates your nervous system, and in a specific way, it affects your the way your nervous system interacts with your gut for some reason. The head, you know, the head stomach connection thing. And then of course the overall practice is very calming. And at the time when I wasn't as like in tune with my stressors as I feel that I am now, it was a really good way to kind of take myself out of myself for, you know, an hour. And also when I did my teacher training, which I did through Yoga Works, it was me and 15 women in New Jersey, and they were all, most of them were mothers, and most of them were in their 30s or 40s. And it was an emotionally awakening experience for me, and a really warm and wonderful way to kind of get your yoga teacher certification. So the whole experience for me was just very special, and it was a particularly transitional time in my life. And I got married, and you know, there was like all sorts of kind of good things were happening all together. So the yoga is almost more symbolically for me was a really good thing. But what it did do, so what that did in conjunction with me also becoming a volunteer EMT, was that I have a much better knowledge of the body now and what things mean, what things don't mean, more importantly. And I know that if, you know, I am feeling weird in one part of my body, I always know the right stretch to do now to kind of deal with it right away, which is a nice set of knowledge. But what I also took out of that experience was that meditation has very different meanings to very different people. Or to different people. And this is something that I really stress with my clients. I tell all my clients that they have to meditate. And I get a lot of rolled eyes when they do that, which I understand, because most people think of meditation as sitting in the middle of a room with your legs crossed and your eyes closed, not saying anything and clearing your mind. But for me, that's not meditation. For me, I mean, that is for some people, but in general, to me, that's not the definition of meditation. To me, meditation is anything that gives you that opportunity to kind of take yourself out of yourself and just have a new perspective and kind of like a breath of fresh air. So for me personally, yoga is not my meditation. It's something that's very special to me and was a physical experience. My meditation is the Israeli martial art Krav Maga, which I don't know if you're, I know you actually, you've written about it on your site too. Yeah. So getting in a, I boxed for 8 years when I was in high school and in college, and I'm a yellow belt in Krav Maga now. And, it's getting in a fight or kind of kicking someone's ass, basically, or getting your ass kicked. It's like the Fight Club thing. It's no joke. To me, that's meditation.
You know, the idea of pure focus is a part of things that when I was younger, if I could get going 30 miles an hour on a relatively gnarly trail on a mountain bike, like you can't not pay 100% attention, because if you don't do it right, you hit a tree. And it's the same sort of thing where you put everything you have into something, and that'll put you in a certain like focused state where actually a flow state. certainly, and I've practiced martial arts. I'm a yellow belt in judo. I don't practice now, but it's the same exact sort of thing. And you also have to get around your fear in both those situations and set your fear aside. You know, is the guy going to hit me in the face? Am I going to get hurt? You just have to execute in the face of fear. And that does something unique to the brain.
Yeah, and there was a funny little result of that too, is when I trained for a year for the Ironman, and I did Ironman France, which is considered to be like the second hardest Ironman. And the swim,
it's all the cheese and wine, or is it the cheese and wine that makes it hard along the way, or was it something else?
That would be nice. Yes, actually, people did come out, but believe it or not, it's funny because I did the half Ironman in New Orleans, and you know the official like aid stations, they have, you know, crackers and Gatorade and even Coca-Cola. But in New Orleans, people are coming out of their house with plates of crab cakes. And it's like the last thing that you want to see when you're going. So doing the biking in France through these little, you know, people were literally standing there with croissants. And, you know, I'm sure that I saw wheels of brie at some point. It's like all those things that you do not want. They think you want it, but you don't. So it's hard just because you're swimming the Mediterranean, and then the bike is part of the Tour de France, basically, and there's 6,000 feet of climb, and then the run is just notoriously boring. But basically, I was ready, I felt good, but then I was really getting nervous about the swim, and mostly because Ironman swimming is a very aggressive sport in itself, and people get very aggressive. And handsy and elbows go flying and people just swim right through you. So I was really worried about that. And I got in the water and about 300 yards, and I'm swimming along and everything felt good. And about 300 yards in, this guy hit me in the back of the head with a closed fist. And it was, really hard. And it immediately like snapped in my head. I was like, wait a minute, I've been hit before. I've done Krav Maga. Like, this doesn't matter. So I swam over that guy, and then I was good. And then I was good for the rest of the time. So it was like that extra benefit.
So you definitely engaged yourself on like a full body and a cognitive level using competitive sports. What about, you know, the sitting with your legs crossed, sort of the mind, basically turn off the voice in your mind versus instead of like pure focus, sort of pure distributed focus. Do you have a practice like that that's helped you heal? I mean, there's pranayama and yoga. You're probably ohmed in your yoga classes and more that side of things. Do you do that too?
You know, I probably should do that more. I always found that the breath control stuff did actually help me quite a bit and felt really good. But to be perfectly honest, I can't tell you the last time where I was in a situation where I got like really stressed out all of a sudden and I needed to kind of remove myself from the situation and calm down. I just kind of developed this more overall calm about these situations now. So I almost feel like I'm in a bit of a meditative state like all the time now. And a lot of that has to do with the less doing stuff, which, you know, that came about a year ago where I started to really systematically become more productive. And, you know, by more productive, I mean basically managing my time better.
It's interesting, the getting things done in philosophy is very much the same thing, that you can reduce your stress very dramatically just by knowing that your system is in place. Before we go into your productivity tips, which we're about to do, I wanted to mention on the sort of the focused sort of state that helped you achieve that calmness, so you can be calm and centered in any situation. With my clients, I find that the M wave, the heart rate variability training, I could do that with someone who I tell them, look, you need to meditate. And they're like, look, I do meditate, but they don't. Or they just look at me and kind of they say, that's for wusses. I'm too busy to meditate, which is a very common thing. And so it's something I would have said. If someone told me to meditate, you know, 15 years ago, I'd have been like, you know what? You're obviously kooky. I don't want anything to do with you. Like, you're not scientific. Yeah. When I apply math to this, I'm like, well, you don't have to meditate. You just need to make your heart rate follow this certain pattern. It takes all the judgment out, but it still helps people who haven't maybe mastered that sit still and you know, don't let anything come into your head. I was never that good at that until I learned to control the heart rate. And then all of a sudden I reached that state where, you know, I'm not really going to get mad at anything. It's not really worth it.
Yeah. So first of all, before I started to get like in better shape, my resting heart rate was 86 when I was 23 or 24 years old, which is ridiculous. And my blood pressure was 120 or 130 over like like 100, which is also kind of ridiculous for a 23 or 24 year old. And then at the end of all this, and it's not, I mean, obviously a large part of this was Ironman training and getting in better shape. But I think the aspect of it that I associate with the calmness is that I used to get what my doctor called white coat hypertension, where I knew what my blood pressure was, but then if I went into the doctor's office and they tested it, it would like systematically be 15% higher. So that doesn't happen anymore. And my resting heart rate now is 52 and my blood pressure is usually around 100/70, you know? So if there's a marker of like being more chill, I would say that that's pretty much it. The, I have not yet taken the leap to work on it, to try the heart rate variability stuff, because obviously I've read about that on your site a lot. I don't know. I haven't, like, the need hasn't arisen yet to really dive into it, but I actually have recommended it to two of my clients to look into it. The thing about being too busy to meditate is really funny, because there's this book that I bought a while ago, or a few months ago, just because of the title is amazing, but it's called Take a Nap and Change Your Life. And it's literally, this entire book is just about like how to take a better nap, when to take a better nap, why naps are good for you. And there's a section on how to justify to other people why you're taking a nap. And it's like question and answer. One of them was like, aren't you too busy to nap? And it's like, no, I'm so busy that I have to take a nap.
You know, Winston Churchill actually said that a lot. You know, he said he couldn't have handled the World War II stuff if he hadn't been napping every day. And definitely, I think there's a great case for that. And we'll make sure we include a link to that book. We'll find it on the web, just so people can find it in the show notes, because it sounds awesome. I haven't read it, but I want to.
Yeah.
Ari, speaking of stress, one of the things you're also a master of is productivity. What do you think are probably the three top tips for productivity that you could tell our listeners?
Okay. Well, I sort of developed this framework, which is to optimize, then automate, and then outsource. And I've used that to pretty much work with people to attack kind of any problem that they possibly could have. So in a generalized sense, that would be my answer. But they basically, first you look at what is the task? What is the problem? What is the issue that I'm, whatever it is that I'm dealing with? Then trying to pare that down to the bare minimum and trimming all the fat and getting it down to the very basic of what that thing is. Then you can attack it by trying to automate as much as possible, whether that's through web applications or just protocols that you have set up with other people. And then if there's anything left after it's been optimized and automated, then you can outsource it. The goal with everything that I do, with the less doing, is to free up your time, but more importantly, to free up your mind. And as far as I'm concerned, if you can free up an hour or a minute or even a second of somebody's time, it's worth it. Because, you know, we already only have a limited ability to use our brain, obviously. And we waste a lot of that activity. We waste a lot of that those resources on things that don't matter and shouldn't matter. The things that we really want to do and that we really enjoy doing and that we really want to think about, you know, kind of get pushed by the wayside by the things that we think that we have to do. And the way that this really struck me in retrospect was that in high school, I was getting literally an idea for a business every day. I have a notebook from high school that probably has 30 pages of business ideas in it. And I'd say 99% of them are terrible, but I had these ideas all the time. And then when I get to college, I was having those ideas maybe once a week. And after college, they stopped. And I was working in construction 18 hours a day, and I was not coming up with new, interesting, creative ideas. And I just chalked it up to not having a sense of creativity anymore, you know, that like I had in my youth. Of course, I said this when I was like 20 years old, but basically, I was not allowing myself to the freedom of my using my mind. So the whole idea of this was just free up your time, free up your mind. And once I started doing this stuff and alleviating the things that I really didn't need to be thinking about and creating the external brain of note-taking and offloading as much as possible, ideas started coming back, which was just like the most amazing feeling ever. It was like parts of my brain being reawakened. And by the way, and incidentally, as far as the stress aspect goes with productivity, I wrote an article on my blog a few days ago about getting rid of your to-do list and not having to-do lists, period. And then just by happenstance, I found this thing called the Zeigarnik effect, which is a psychological effect that basically causes intrusive thoughts about things that we've left incomplete. So it's human nature to finish what we start. And if it's not finished, we experience dissonance. So basically we have this little voice in our head that we don't even know about that's constantly bugging us about tasks that we have to do that we haven't done. So kind of quieting that voice is a really important aspect of us.
In my coaching experience as an executive coach and mentoring entrepreneurs, I can't think of one time when I've spoken with someone who hasn't said, I have that voice in my head that just won't shut up. And I've kind of forgotten what that's like, because the racing thoughts, it's oftentimes something that affects sleep. I don't have that anymore. It's completely gone. And when I look back a decade ago, it was, you know, constant, you know, basically sitting there criticizing everything I would do, which was totally hampering my effectiveness. I was still kicking ass as an entrepreneur, but I was doing it because, like, I had this little, you know, voice in my head, like, you know, snarling at me all the time to do more and do better. And it's pretty different once you learn that, like, you're in charge of that voice. And the process of learning that certainly can come from having a big illness, and it can come from a bunch of different directions. There's the martial arts and the really pushing yourself athletically. And there are a bunch of other ways. And one of the things I'm working on with the Bulletproof Executive is enumerating those ways and trying to map them out to which types of people do better with which types of techniques, so that we can do a better job of guiding people who read the blog, but also people, you know, when I talk to them on the street, say, you should do the M-Wave, you should do neurofeedback, you should do pranayama, and you should do like two Ironmans back to back, right? So there's some way to do that. Do you have a methodology there with your coaching clients? Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. You know, there's never a one size fits all or one size fits all. It's funny because I have such a diverse range of problems coming at me with people, which is great. It's a really interesting challenge, but there's always these unifying factors. And it seems like in a general sense, the thing that just causes people an enormous amount of stress is, and this is going to sound overly general, but is not being able to do the things they want to do. And that can be on big levels, like they're not making enough money, or it can be they're not being able to spend time with their significant other, or they're not happy with their significant other and they're not being able to be with the people that do make them happy in certain situations, or they have a disease that's making them in pain. So it's this, I guess it's like a very, very basic human want to not be able to have what you want. So what I find consistently with every single one of my clients is that they do not set appropriate goals and much less appropriate milestones. So that's usually my first plan of attack with people, is figuring out really what they want, because what they think they want is usually not what they really want. I have a client right now who thought that he, you know, and he's 46 years old, and he's been very successful, in my opinion, although he doesn't kind of recognize that himself. And he thought that he wanted to do a tech startup. And there was no way in my mind that a 46-year-old who has already been successful and has two kids wants to do a tech startup. and with working through this with him, we kind of figured out what he really did want. And it was something entirely different, and that's what we're working on now. But the goal setting thing is just the most amazing thing on me. So the one of these examples that I just love is, you know, SEALFIT, which is, you know, like the SEAL version of CrossFit.
Yep.
So they have their hell week, or actually the SEALs have their hell week too, which is, you know, literally a week of not sleeping and constant movement and exercise and psychological torture. And the head coach of that program, who's Mark Devine, said, you know, the worst thing that can happen is if somebody comes in this and they say, I just have to make it to Friday. I just have to make it to Friday. They said, because that person will not make it to Friday. An appropriate goal for a person coming into hell week is to say, I want to make it to sunrise. And then once you get there, then you've accomplished something, and then you can set a new goal. And that's what I'm constantly working on with my clients, is setting reasonable goals. Because I'm sure you have had this experience with clients of yours, but you know, if somebody comes to you and they say, I want to lose 30 pounds, like that to me is not a reasonable goal. You have to be like, I want to, you know, do you want to lose a pound a week? Do you want to, you know, do you want to exercise more? Do you want to, why do you want to lose that? Do you want to fit into something? Do you want to look better? Do you want to feel like, what is the goal? What is the actual goal there? Saying this arbitrarily, I want to lose 30 pounds, to me, is not a really good way to start things.
Yeah, and without a timeline is sort of not that meaningful of a goal. That's for sure. And if you couch it in the terms of benefits, you know, I want to lose 30 pounds because it changes things.
Right.
So you're definitely a fan of that. And I can see that dynamic mapping back to my experience. You know, when I was 26, I found that I was worth $6 million on paper before my company went bankrupt. And I'm like, God, you know, I'll stop when I'm worth 10. And the difference between $6 million and $10 million is pretty much invisible. Like, when you have that much money, you're like, I want something, I'll buy it. And, you know, unless it's an island, it doesn't really matter. So that was, I would say, youth and inexperience on my side. And if I played that game over again, there's a very simple rule, which is, you know, sell half. So, you know, pocket right. half of it and put the rest in risk if you feel like you want to keep doing something. But most people, especially when they're younger, when they succeed, is, you know, they double down. And that's not always the right strategy because there's no goal behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also I feel personally like I've been successful in the businesses I've done, although I can relate with what you're talking about, because when I was 23 years old, I had $3 million of debt in real estate. So that was an interesting experience in itself. And obviously I was under a lot more stress then. But now I feel that I've been and am fairly successful, but I still enjoy optimizing the way that we spend money and, you know, being able, it not being necessarily what might be considered frugal, but, you know, figuring out, kind of gaming the system, like that never changes in my mind. It's you can always do things more efficiently. So why not do it?
Exactly. You can always basically get that time back as soon as you find a way to do it better, which is kind of cool, because I want to ask you, I've used the personal assistant in the Philippines. I've outsourced enormous amounts of stuff. In fact, there's no way I could be a vice president at Trend Micro and spend, you know, the vast majority of my waking hours doing cloud computing and also do this blog if I wasn't really good at finding people to help and being able to, you know, put my knowledge and experience down, but not spend 40 hours a week doing it. So I've got some thoughts about outsourcing, but I want to hear yours, and maybe we can compare notes after you sort of tell our listeners the techniques you use to use outsourcing.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the funny thing. I don't have a virtual assistant. I use a service called Fancy Hands, which offers non-dedicated virtual assistants. So I do have virtual assistants at my disposal, but I haven't had a dedicated virtual assistant in over a year and a half. Because as I explained in my system, it's optimize, then automate, then outsource. And I've just been able to, fortunately, not have to get to that third step with 99% of the tasks that I do. So this was also an interesting confluence with starting Less Doing. But basically, a year and a half ago, I had been working with a virtual assistant for a year and a half in India, and she was amazing. Her name was Christy, and like, she knew everything. She knew birthdays, she knew credit card numbers, bank accounts, you know, she probably knew how I liked my coffee, even though I never actually met her in person. And this was before Bulletproof Coffee. So she was amazing. And one day she says, I'm being promoted and I'm no longer going to be a virtual assistant. And I went into full on red alert panic mode. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Do I have to retrain somebody? Like, ah. And so after I calmed down, I was like, give me a list of everything that you do for me on a regular basis. And a couple days later, she sent me a list of about 45 tasks. And I looked through them and I realized that 10 of them weren't really applicable and didn't need to be there. Five of them could actually be combined because they were kind of duplicates. And then, then the remaining like 30, of the remaining 30, about 27 of them could be completely automated with web applications that didn't exist when I originally hired her, but now did. So what I was left with was three tasks that really required a person to deal with them. And it was 3 tasks out of 45 that I felt like, you know what, it's okay for me to do these by myself and not have an assistant. So I didn't have an assistant from then on. And then I found Fancy Hands, which is started by Ted Roden, who was a New York Times editor. And it's really awesome. But basically, for $45 a month, I get unlimited tasks. And a task is pretty much anything that takes 20 minutes and anything that can be done remotely. And they'll do, you know, phone calls or reservations or research or whatever you might want them to do. But since it's a non-dedicated assistant, they don't get to know you. They don't get to know your credit card number. You know, they can't buy things for you, that kind of stuff. But using all sorts of other tools like the canned response plugin for Gmail, which lets you create template emails, I can send a repetitive task to someone because it's just a matter of clicking, pulling up the template, and then sending it. So like one of the things that I've automated completely is the process of dealing with parking tickets, because I get a lot of parking tickets.
That's actually kind of funny. I'm just considering parking tickets a cost of doing business. And by the way, I share your experience there with the virtual assistant. I had one for about a year and a half. And then, you know, her agency wanted her to change jobs. And I asked her to maintain a how to run Dave's life list in case she disappeared somewhere. And we took that and gave it to the new person. But the switching cost, the education cost, was actually much higher than I would have thought. So I'm actually going to try Fancy Hands now that you've mentioned it, because I looked at Brickworks and all the stuff that Tim Ferriss talked about in 4-Hour Workweek, and I didn't get what I was looking for there. So I tend to find high quality people and make it worth their while to work with me. But it's one of those things. It's not as simple as it looks in some of these books. So you may have hit nirvana here. I think people should spend a little more time looking at your blog.
Yeah, I feel that. So first of all, one of the things with Fancy Hands, which you don't get with most virtual assistant companies, is that all of the people that Fancy Hands uses are either in the US or in the UK. So they have perfect language skills, which is, you know, like the holy grail, obviously, when it comes to virtual assistants. So I'm very comfortable having them call people for me and communicate with people. I wrote this little ebook, which is only 16 pages long, about how to work with a virtual assistant. And in it, I list over 100 things that you can have virtual assistants do. And the truth is that the majority of the things that you can have people do, you don't necessarily need a dedicated assistant. And in thinking efficiently and optimizing, obviously, investing in a person that you never met and will never meet, you know, carry some inherent risk with it. So if you can run, you know, clean and lean, basically, and anybody could take over a task for you without any input on your part, then obviously you've done something right. So the parking ticket one is a really interesting one for me. And it's also has not escaped from the quantified self aspect. So I have a commercial pickup truck. I have a pickup truck, a Chevy Avalanche. But you know, I'm in the construction business, so I have my name on the side of the truck. And in New York City, you can pretty much park a truck wherever you want for up to a half an hour because it's considered loading and unloading. So realistically, I do park in front of my building on the street for much more than half an hour at a time. And I pretty much get a parking ticket almost every day. And sometimes twice. So yes, you're right. It's the cost of doing business. And as far as I'm concerned, parking in New York City, you know, the cheapest I could park for a month in New York City around my area is $600. So if I pay less than that in parking tickets, as far as I'm concerned, I'm doing okay. So the process of this is very simple. I have Boomerang Mail is a plugin for Gmail, and it allows you to send, among other things, it allows you to send recurring emails. So I have a recurring email that goes to Fancy Hands, and it's a template that I've created. So it's as if I had somebody dedicated to me who automatically would check my parking tickets for me, but this is someone, every time it's someone new, and I've never had a problem with this. So the template says, first of all, please go to the New York City Department of Finance website, click on parking tickets, view any parking tickets for the last 2 weeks, and take note of them. Click this link to pull up my standard invoice form. Adjust the, you know, the date of the invoice to match the date of the tickets. Because if you send them an invoice basically saying you're making a delivery, then you can get the tickets dismissed. So adjust the date of the invoice to match the date of the ticket. Include this letter that has my signature explaining that I was making a delivery at the time, and adjust the date of that as well. Then use the service called Postal Methods, which lets you send a PDF through the mail. and done. So, and the final step is go to this Google Doc form and input all these details about the tickets. So what I've done with that Google Doc form is that I have found out over the hundreds of tickets that I've gotten over the last couple of years that Wednesday between 9 and 11 and Tuesdays between 2 and 4 are the really, really bad times to get tickets. And by avoiding those times, I've been able to reduce the number of tickets by 40%. And of the tickets that they dispute for me, 9 out of 10 get dismissed. And the one or two that I end up paying a month amounts to about $180.
That is hilarious. And that is a prime example of quantified self, not just monitoring, you know, your heart rate or something, but monitoring your behaviors, looking at the external environment, doing the math and seeing an advantage. I think that's actually just funny and very, very smart.
Thank you. And the most important thing about that is that I'm doing that with a non-dedicated assistant who I've never met. I don't even speak to them because it's their email and I don't have to explain anything. And I probably will never get that person again. And yet it runs seamlessly.
That is a great example of outsourcing. Well, we're coming down to the end of the show here. So I'd like to ask you a couple things. And the first one is, if you had to lay down just three things that people can do to improve their performance across all domains to improve the quality of their life, what are your top three things just off the top of your head? Any domain.
Okay. So my number one productivity tool is followup.cc. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it's the most important productivity tool that I use on a daily basis about 20 times a day. It's very simple. Basically, if you send an email, you can CC or BCC any time period you want at followup.cc. So I might send you an email, Dave, and then BCC 2 days at followup.cc. If you don't get back to me in 2 days, it will resend you the email as a reminder and send it to me as well. If I BCC it, it'll just send me the reminder. You can set any time period you want, whether it's 1 month at followup.cc, Thursday, 9 p.m. at followup.cc, 1 year at followup.cc. And it also can put all of those follow-ups in your calendar. So what this has enabled me to do is get rid of my to-do list, because as far as I'm concerned, to-do lists make static something that should be dynamic. So I get follow-ups that are relevant to following up with somebody that I met at a party and might want to do business with, following up on a client that I sent a bill to, following up with a customer service agent that I want to make sure I get a refund from. Basically, at this point, I've gotten into the habit that if I do a followup.cc on an email, within 3 or 4 seconds of sending the email, I could not tell you what the email was about because it's completely out of sight and out of mind. So that's the number one thing. The second thing as far as wellness is, I feel that unfortunately people, at least in this country, do not get enough probiotics in their diet. And I think that probiotics are an enormously important aspect of health. I'm a particular fan of the GNC 75 because most probiotic pills are, you know, 4 billion units or 8 billion units, whereas the GNC one is 75 billion units. And I actually can feel it from day to day if I miss it. People think that you can get that from eating yogurt, but you'd have to eat like 14 cartons of yogurt to get a significant amount of probiotics.
Yogurt's laughable. I would just say as a probiotic source, that's just marketing. Like Coke isn't a good source of CO2 either. Like it just doesn't make sense.
Anyway, yes. Go ahead. we don't eat, as far as I'm concerned, enough fermented foods in this country either. So, which is kind of the tip of the iceberg of us being too clean and having allergies and all sorts of stuff, which I don't need to necessarily get into. But I think that if you're going to do one thing in addition, probiotics. I happen to take a few supplements like krill oil and cat's claw and other things. But the silver bullet, as far as I'm concerned, for most people and most problems, whether it's autoimmune or rheumatoid arthritis or bad digestion, I think that probiotics are a hugely important thing. And then the third thing is that I think that everybody at some point should work with a virtual assistant, and whether or not they think they have the time, like, because most people tell me like, oh, I'm too busy to train somebody or talk to somebody or whatever. That is the exact person who needs to work with a virtual assistant, not necessarily because the virtual assistant will help them with their time, which they obviously will, but because the process of working with a remote assistant is a training experience and an education experience for you. People start to realize when they have to write down a task in email and they go, you know, it shouldn't take 10 minutes to explain a task by email. And I think that people start to learn as they go through that, oh, this is an easier way of saying it. And, oh, I don't have to do that step. And, oh, maybe I should just have them do this. And, oh, this whole task is actually pointless. So forget it. I won't ask them to do it. So I think that everybody at some point needs to work with a virtual assistant. And actually, to that end, the quality of the assistant is less important because it's more about your ability to kind of educate, train, and communicate.
It's funny. I love the idea of a virtual assistant as a path to mindfulness, but it works. Ari, thank you for taking your time to be on our show today. Can you tell our listeners where they can find out more about you?
Yeah, sure. I've now combined all my websites under Less Doing. So lessdoing.com is where my blog is. It's where you can find out about me and my background, as well as all of my coaching services that I offer. So that's kind of the central hub for everything, lessdoing.com. Do less and get more done.
I very much like your philosophy and definitely support it. Thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll have a full transcript of this posted on Bulletproof Exec so people can search it and find all the things we just talked about today.
If you enjoyed our show today, you can say thanks by going to bulletproofexec.com and maybe trying some upgraded coffee with low toxins that causes big improvements in brain performance. You could simply subscribe to our email list. You can leave us a positive ranking on iTunes, or you can leave a comment on the forum for us to answer, or you can answer someone else's question. We really appreciate the community that's formed there, and we've got thousands of messages there. So there are people who know the Bulletproof program who will answer your questions for you, and we will too.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.